Good morning. Happy to be here. I sometimes wish I was in South Africa doing work when I sit in Atlanta at CDC. So I would say that this is something that I feel passionate about. I think this is a very important activity that's going on, initially started with NIH and WHO, and at CDC we have joined the effort to really look at clearly articulating a roadmap for STI vaccines. As you know, we've been trying to treat our way out of STD control for how many years with bacterial STDs and aren't making good progress. And I think that we really need to make the case that having vaccines in our toolkit would be unbelievable. So what I'm going to do is talk through what Dr. Reese was going to say here today, why we need STI vaccines, what the STI vaccine roadmap looks like, where we are with sort of the development of the various STI vaccines, and then leave you with some action steps that we need everybody to be involved in this effort, because you're going to see that it's complicated. It's not just having bench researchers working in test tubes to figure out how we're going to design vaccines. There's a lot that goes in to making the case for STI vaccines. So we all know that STIs have a profound impact on sexual, reproductive, and maternal and child health. We also are looking at this from a global perspective, not just something in high-income countries. STI control is essential for achieving the goals of the global health agenda that WHO has laid out. And actually, there is a new WHO global health sector strategy for STIs that was just endorsed at this year's World Health Assembly by the UN. And in that strategy, STI vaccine development is noted as a key step for future STI control. We also know that we've been very successful with some other sexually transmitted infections like hepatitis B and HPV. And so I think there's now renewed interest that having infections that are sexually transmitted, and originally I think the HPV vaccine was known as the sex vaccine, but I think now it's being marketed as the cancer vaccine, anti-cancer vaccine, that there's been an embrace that these are important vaccines and things that we need in our toolkit. So I think most of you are well aware in this audience of the adverse outcomes of STIs, and that effectively addressing these adverse outcomes can have the following benefits. So this is important when you're trying to articulate why we all need to be advocating for this roadmap. Clearly, if we had STI vaccines for both syphilis and herpes, we could improve neonatal outcomes, certainly, and some benefits with chlamydia and gonorrhea. We know about the advances in HPV in preventing cancer. Chlamydia and gonorrhea contribute significantly to the burden of infertility on a global level, so having a chlamydia and gonorrhea vaccine would decrease the burden of infertility. We know that all STIs are related to facilitating HIV transmission, so there would be that benefit. And obviously, this sort of emerging concern of the threat of untreatable gonorrhea, because we're our last line of antibiotic in our pipeline, we are trying to develop new antibiotics, but that takes time and it's been slow. Certainly a vaccine for gonorrhea would certainly mitigate that threat. And then obviously we want to improve the sexual health of young people, as Dr. Hook just talked about, and vaccines could play an important role in this effort. One of the things you need when you start, you know, developing your vaccine roadmap, you have to define that there's actually a problem, and that it has, you know, has quite a bit of problems globally. And there's been some new work done by Lori Newman at WHO coming up with new estimates for STIs that were just published in 2015. We now estimate that about 1 million new STIs are acquired every day. There's an estimated 377 million incident infections, with just chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and trichomoniasis in HSV2 in 2012. You can see on this map the distribution by WHO regions. And this doesn't even count for HPV vaccine, now, HPV infection. We know that's very common, although many people who are infected with HPV actually either clear their infection or it's undetectable for the remaining of their life and have no further problems. It's the ones that have persistent HPV with the oncogenic types that are causing the high rates of global cervical cancer in the world. Clearly, when we're articulating the need for vaccines, we have to highlight our current control challenges that we have in the field of STD control. There's been limited progress made with condom promotion as our main prevention message. This is not just in the United States, it's also globally. As also noted by Dr. Hook, most of these infections are asymptomatic, so individuals don't know that they're infected, so they don't come in and seek the testing and treatment that they need. And at least worldwide, many places do not have access to STI diagnosis. They're still using syndromic management and treating people that come in with symptoms and empirically treating them for what we think they have. And there's no diagnostic test available to really understand, is that genital ulcer from chancroid, herpes, or syphilis, or is that discharge from chlamydia, gonorrhea, trick, or other things. And clearly syndromic management has its limitations with specificity, especially when you're talking about vaginal discharge. As I mentioned, we think that vaccines for gonorrhea are going to be a key tool to address how this organism that quickly mutates once we find an antibiotic to treat it with. It would be very helpful if we could have vaccines to just prevent infection completely. And as you all are aware, both in the United States and internationally, we are having significant problems with penicillin shortages that are hindering our syphilis treatment and control worldwide and really hindering our ability to prevent congenital syphilis. Penicillin is the only drug that we have that is available to treat congenital syphilis. We have no other drugs, and it's very challenging what you're going to do in terms of managing women who are identified with syphilis, and then you have no penicillin to give that woman. And we recognize still the problems with the stigmatizing issues and little public policy attention. So we're hoping this vaccine roadmap will garner the support to further further achievement of the goal of achieving vaccines. So this effort really started in 2013, where WHO and NIAID at NIH had a technical consultation on STI vaccines, and there was a special issue of vaccine, so this is an important thing to read, that was issued in the journal Vaccine in 2013. What was laid out was a roadmap of the need and where we are, and future work that needs to be done to develop herpes vaccines, chlamydia, gonorrhea, T. pallidum, and trichomoniasis. And since then, there has been an update showing where we are. So what was outlined at that meeting is there are really 9 priority action areas that we need to work on for our STI vaccine roadmap. So you can start seeing there's a lot of areas that we can use a lot of help from. First, our epidemiologists. You need epi data to determine the burden of these infections worldwide. We need to improve our understanding of STI natural history and burden of sequelae, so we can also do our modeling that can actually look at the theoretical impact and costs of STI vaccines. Clearly, you need to have that basic science research to develop the vaccines. We need to be conducting basic and translational studies in human clinical settings as soon as possible. When you're working in the field of vaccines, there's a term called, you'll hear people talking about PPC, which stands for preferred product characteristics, which is important if there's going to be acceptability of these vaccines. The feeling for the roadmap is we need to expedite our development and an evaluation. We need to start planning introduction and hopefully soon have more investment in this STI vaccine development. So since then, there's been another article written, sort of giving us sort of a state of where we are on our roadmap for advancing the development of vaccines against STIs, and I'm going to quickly overview sort of where we are on that roadmap today. For some vaccines, we're doing quite well. And so this is the current status of the development pathway for STI vaccines. So as you can see, herpes vaccines, pretty far along the curve. They're in clinical evaluation trials right now. Trichomoniasis, not so much. We're still at the basic science level. I would say chlamydia is next in line in terms of advancement and getting close to clinical evaluation. Neisseria gonorrhea is in the preclinical development, and I'm excited to hear that we're having more interest in the development of a syphilis vaccine given the current epidemics that at least we're seeing in the United States, and it's always had high burden globally as well. So to make the case, I'm going to go through each of these infections, except I'm not going to cover trichomoniasis because that's really sort of still at the basic science stage. But to make the case for a herpes vaccine, we know that herpes is the leading cause of genital ulcer disease worldwide. It has significant impact on the quality of individuals' lives who live with this chronic infection. We know also that HIV acquisition and transmission is influenced by HSV2 infections, and we also are just beginning to learn more in the story of what's going on with HSV1 genital infections. And we also know that herpes infecting the neonate is actually very significant with high mortality rates. That's probably the most significant adverse outcome, and certainly a vaccine would reduce neonatal herpes worldwide. Looking at the HSV2 estimates that have been presented in 2015, these are data from 2012, overall we estimate there's about 417 million infections globally that were detected at least in 2012. And again, you can look at the numbers based on the regional areas of WHO. The estimates of HSV1 infection can vary a little bit in the studies that are done, depending on the methodologic ways that they're measuring genital HSV1 infection. It's very difficult to sort out with some of our tests that we have whether or not we're actually measuring genital infection versus oral herpes. But overall, it's estimated that about 3.7 billion people between the ages of up to 49 are actually infected with HSV1 globally. And if you try to tease out how much of that is genital HSV1 infection, the current estimates are somewhere between 140 to 239 million adults. We know that we're starting to see more HSV1 in the genitals in high-income countries. And obviously, our data are less precise in Africa and Southeast Asia. But if we look together at both HSV2 and HSV1, we've got more than 500 million people with genital HSV infection worldwide. Again, I'm not going to go through all the details, but globally, there's been a lot of interest in HSV whenever there's anything that comes out about HSV, and I will say, at least at CDC, that our herpes fact sheets really get the number one hit from public who are concerned about STIs in the United States. So we know there's a lot of concern about this infection today. And again, looking at the neonatal herpes estimates, again, there's about a 60% fatality rate without treatment. There's long-term neurologic deficits, and we need to be getting better estimates of those both in the United States and follow trends as well as internationally. We know that the numbers in low-income countries may be a little bit higher. They do not have the option of C-sections when someone presents with active herpetic lesions at the time of delivery. So we really need to be getting better data. And we're very excited about the CHAMPS study, which is looking at perinatal mortality. It's funded by the Gates Foundation and others. And they've actually added neonatal herpes into their list of the 25 diseases that's hard to get on their list. So we're very excited to see that they're going to be evaluating HSV1 and HSV2 and related neonatal outcomes. And again, just sort of looking at the business case that is being developed for HSV vaccine, this would be a similar business case that we would be using for other STI vaccines. First, you've got to know the disease burden and costs. You've got to model the vaccine impact and also look at the market demand. And then you've got the preferred patient characteristics and target product profiles. You've got to look at your return on investment. And that's all done with the basic science and technologic work developing these vaccine products and developing the cost strategies. For the herpes vaccines, it's actually interesting, and it's important to recognize that there's both prophylactic vaccines, which means they're going to actually prevent the infection, versus therapeutic vaccines, which basically is going to reduce the symptoms of these infections. And so when you're looking at the field of HSV vaccines, and it's important to recognize we only have HSV2 vaccines right now that are being studied clinically, you need to know what endpoint is being looked at. Is it basically seroconversion and disease is the endpoint, or is it genital shedding and recurrences? So I'm running out of time. So in the interest of the vaccines that are available, currently 5, but this field is moving, so there might be more vaccines. But it's important to note that The Geneseea vaccine has just completed their phase 2 trial and actually have been able to show a significant reduction in lesion rate by 60% and shedding by 55%, and that was actually a sustained reduction over a 12-month period. So stay tuned for that. So obviously next steps are preferred product characteristics of vaccine, consensus building on what type of clinical evaluation needs to be done. There's always a lot of debates about endpoints. And how we're going to evaluate these, especially in low-resource countries. And obviously, there's got to be coordination of the HSV vaccine business case and modeling and incorporating HIV, neonatal herpes, and HSV-1 in these models. So the case for chlamydia, I'll quickly review. I think most of you know it's common. It disproportionately affects adolescents. It causes reproductive health problems of infertility, ectopic pregnancy, chronic pelvic pain. And we have not been very successful bringing our chlamydia screening programs to scale, although we have seen some success in some of our outcomes declining, at least in the United States. Again, 131 million cases of chlamydia worldwide. And the vaccine approaches that are currently under development are looking at subunits based on the chlamydia major outer membrane proteins, looking at sort of inactivated vaccines and live attenuated plasmid deficient vaccines. And there's also been some scientific advances in sort of genetic manipulation and also reverse vaccinology and proteomics and novel adjuvants. So there's some really exciting work in the chlamydia world. And again, we at least have a number of vaccines that are looking at different MOP antibodies, other different kinds of targets. But as you can see, most vaccines are in the preclinical trials, and we've only got one phase 1 trial that was started in 2006, but that's progress. We at least have one trial in phase 1. So again, similar things that need to be looked at for the chlamydia vaccine in terms of endpoints, trial design. We're trying to get better measures of our outcomes, serologic biomarkers of infertility, et cetera. So obviously there's a lot of work that we need to be doing. And again, a question that came up with HPV vaccine is being asked about chlamydia vaccine. Do we want to have our target population be pre-adolescent vaccines for girls, or do we want to be vaccinating girls and boys? As I mentioned, the threat of untreatable gonorrhea is fueling interest in a gonorrhea vaccine. What I find very interesting is there's a lot of investment by NIH in this area, and there are at least four approaches that are being looked at in preclinical trials. One of the things that I would really like to mention, having started my career doing Neisseria meningitis work and vaccine in Africa, is actually the Neisseria meningitis people have kind of finished their work. And there's an interesting study in New Zealand, and I believe it's going to be presented here, where they vaccinated for Neisseria meningitis in an STD clinic and actually reduced the rate of gonorrhea, not chlamydia, with the meninge vaccine. So we're hoping that the world of Neisseria meningitis researchers are come to join us in the STD world and can help advance vaccines for Neisseria gonorrhea. So I think this is an exciting time, and I'm hoping that we will be getting beyond the preclinical stage soon. And then lastly, as I mentioned, we've been trying to treat our way about syphilis control since the syphilis benzathine became available, and also because of our shortages of penicillin, I think there is a huge need for a syphilis vaccine both in this country and worldwide. And we are beginning to make progress in the syphilis vaccine roadmap. The modeling is being done to understand the benefits and the economic rationale for a vaccine versus screening and treatment programs. There's been some advancement in our basic science research. I have heard rumors that Carolyn Deal and NIH is going to be hosting a meeting in next year and sort of in the spring to bring together scientists to really have a focused discussion on how we can advance the syphilis vaccine. So what can you do to help this effort? We need everybody involved. It's, as we always say, it takes a village, and that's why we have different people coming up and presenting other people's talks. So we definitely need better epidemiologic data about the burden of these infections. We need to improve the understanding of the natural history and sequelae. We need better models, economic and models. We need better basic science, translational studies, and we really need to expedite this effort. And I think that I speak for Helen and Carolyn Deal at NIH. We all look forward to working with you on this initiative. So thank you very much.